Well, Sigmund Freud said it pretty well. Love and work are the cornerstones of our humanness. If we love and work, we can feel that our lives have a purpose, that there's some significance to what we do. Our ancestors thought work was so important that many of them bore names identifying their occupations: archer, baker, cartwright, dyer. The most common last name or surname in the United States is an occupational surname. What do you think it is? It's Smith, exactly. In German, it's Schmidt. In Italian, it's Ferraro. In fact, Wikipedia, you know, the fount of all wisdom, has in it 200 pages of occupational surnames. Some are Germanic languages, some are Romance, Turkish, Chinese. Those surnames exist in a lot of cultures. Now, in our own congregation, we have the name King, which didn't mean quite royalty, although we're willing to believe that our kings are royalty, but it designated a clan chief, or maybe somebody who played the king every year in a local mystery play. Threadgill denotes an embroiderer, one so skilled, right, that he or she was permitted to embroider with gold thread. So work is not just what we do for money. I happen to think that people who are described as stay-at-home parents or stay-at-home caregivers of any description are in fact people who stay at work all the time, every minute of every day. Now, today we're going to take a wide-ranging but hardly conclusive look at work and its relationship to our souls, our spiritual lives. And we're going to be drawing from such sources as Studs Terkel, Henry Ford, Karl Marx, and the Book of Deuteronomy. But let's consider now what it means to want work and not have it.
When I noticed Susan's call for poems or other readings for this worship service on work in the February 15th order of worship, I immediately thought of two poems. And I couldn't remember their author or their titles, but I entered the lines I remembered in my Google search box, and I found the poems. And I also found that the author, Philip Levine, had died the previous day. Levine was our poet of grit, sweat, and labor. As his New York Times obituary said, he was the U.S. Poet Laureate for 2011-2012. He won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry and two National Book Awards for poetry. The two poems I remembered refer to the same period of Levine's life when he and his brother, both around 20 years old, shared a room with his brother working night shift and Levine working or looking for work during the day. So here is one of those poems. It's the title poem from his book, What Work Is. We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers. And of course, it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in, to rain, to the hours of wasted work waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead a man is waiting who will say, "No, we are not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide, and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious, not because you're too young or too dumb, not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
Good morning. I'm Diane Carreri, and I'm a dental hygienist. That kind of sounds like the beginning of the AA meeting, but if you don't know somebody who does the work I do, you should, and I encourage you to get out there and find one. I earned my license in 1976. You remember the bicentennial. And I worked for a time, and then I went to graduate school and worked as a healthcare research administrator. But when our son was born, I wanted to work part-time in a job that didn't require as much of me and take such mental space. So I returned to dental hygiene and have worked in a practice on University Ave for almost 20 years. My work requires me to cross personal barriers, to get up close and personal, I embody in your face. And many people don't like the work that I do, and they express it personally. Our UU principle of finding the inherent worth and dignity of all in all has helped me to surmount their discomfiture by finding connections. And one method is a compliment. Congratulations on coming in today. For those who haven't been to the dentist for years, it's a big step, and it's great you took it. We're glad to see you. Another is to have a world atlas handy to allow those who didn't grow up here to show their country and their city and talk about their place. It's a nice way of making them feel welcomed. Our office is across the street from the University of Washington, and it brings us students from all over the world, many of whom have never had dental care. For these patients, it takes a lot of patience, because I'll often spend 5 one-hour appointments bringing them back to good health. And they're remarkably grateful patients. We have children who come to us for the first time, and it's wonderful fun to allow them to use the squirt gun and the air squirter. You just put a little water in mom's mouth. Oops, you missed. That's okay. It's just water. We have a lot of senior patients because our office was built in the late 50s, and it's a great pleasure to help people find those nooks and crannies and help them prevent decay on roots, which are exposed from gum recession. I like helping people have healthy mouths and to prevent diseases of all kinds because of the oral systemic connection. I connect regularly with about 1,200 others, and I like to think I motivate them, at least for a little while, by the advice that I can share. I also enjoy expanding my connections in my community, saying hello to somebody at your bookstore or at a grocery store, on a hiking trail, at church. My family lives in Michigan, but my dental family is all around. And just like my church family, it's my web of life. Work defines us. Jobs and professions carry associated stereotypes and a hierarchical placement in our social order. They indicate the extent of our education. And there's no way around the fact that work defines our social standing. But again, our principles come into play. Work, a profession, offers an opportunity to appreciate all services rendered. A tip for the hotel housekeeper, a wave and a hello to the garbage guy, a handshake to your AARP tax preparer, or namaste to your meditation teacher. It's said that Americans live to go to work, whereas other societies, Western societies, work to live life. And I think that expression is often said by the ones who aren't Americans. But it is certain that we have to strive for our safety net, healthcare, retirement, a pension, whereas other countries can have such services provided via a robust tax system. Nevertheless, any worker, paid, volunteer, retired and volunteering, or independently wealthy, can choose to adopt an attitude where work and life coexist and enhance each other. That wonderful feminist writer, Merriam-Webster, offers this definition of work: an activity or job done regularly, especially to earn money, which uses personal strengths or faculties. And I think it's up to each of us to find the joy and the balance between our efforts in life and in work.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name's Carrie Cameron, and I'm a longtime member here. One of the first things people ask when getting acquainted is, "So, what do you do?" This question usually catches me off guard, and I stammer, "Well, I'm a part-time custodian at my church, and I do odd jobs like cat sitting and giving people rides." If my acquaintance raises an eyebrow, I imagine he's wondering how I support myself. So I meekly explain, I actually receive disability benefits as my main source of income. I continue to see his wheels turning. Carrie doesn't look disabled. She must either be lazy or mentally ill. After an awkward exchange, he finds someone else to talk to. I flash back to the nickname I half-jokingly gave myself in high school, Pariah Carrie. I have felt like a misfit for most of my life, and having disabilities hasn't helped. In case you're wondering, I suffer from depression, anxiety, attention deficit disorder, and obsessive compulsive personality disorder. My theme song could very well be, "Oh, what a piece of work am I?" But I keep reminding myself that I also have a lot of good qualities. I'm one of the countless college graduates who are unemployed or underemployed. Over the years, I pursued three fields of study that I soon realized wouldn't work for me. Journalism didn't work because I spent so much time fine-tuning my articles that I couldn't meet deadlines. Office work didn't pan out either because I wasn't good at juggling tasks or staying focused on the right task. Damn that beguiling internet. And I realized that I wouldn't make a good recreational therapist or activities director because that line of work is meant for extroverts like Chris Poole, not painfully shy introverts like me. I enjoyed working as a barista, but customers complained that I could never remember their usual drinks. Despite trying my best, I was let go from a lot of jobs. All I ever seemed to hear was, "You're not good enough," which was totally demoralizing. I decided that if I wanted my endeavors to be spiritually fulfilling, I should work or volunteer for a cause that I hold dear. My top cause for many years has been promoting Unitarian Universalism. It seems to me that UUs are more accepting of my quirks and less likely to fire me. For a couple years, I've been serving as this church's assistant custodian. It's not the most glamorous job, but since I am church proud, it lifts my spirit. While a journalism career was not in the cards for me, I've been able to use my writing skills to share helpful information with you in my weekly email, Carrie's Commentaries. And although Starbucks didn't want me, this church appreciates how I organize coffee hour. Donating my driving and pet sitting services to the annual auction was another great way to find sympathetic UU employers. Now here are just a few of the spiritual perks of my various types of work. A miracle to me is winning the trust of a shy kitty, coaxing it out from under the bed. Being all alone in the church or in a client's home soothes the soul of an introvert. Tidying the church helps to satisfy a desire for order in the universe. As we all know, cleanliness is next to godliness. Doing extra custodial work pro bono proves that I'm more devoted to service than to making money. And finally, knowing that I am accepted and even sought after sometimes is spiritually salvific. Many of you have entrusted me with your keys, cars, homes, pets, and children, and you've even had faith that I would get you to SeaTac on time and in one piece. Although I'm the lowliest employee here, and not the most outgoing person by far, I still feel like a big fish at our church. Thank you for affirming my inherent worth and dignity.
When I, listening to Bill singing about laying down burden time, I'm thinking that sometimes the best thing about work is the feeling you get when it's done for the day. But of course, in our world where constant communication is possible, the working day is sometimes never over. For millennia, about 90% of human work was creating change in the physical world around us, and the satisfaction was probably easier to see. A field where the grain had been cut, the sheaves of grain stacked under a shelter, the rabbits for dinner killed and brought home, the sheep sheared, the blanket woven. These days, most of us deal 90% of the time in abstract work. We deal with language or numbers or other human-made concepts. And it's less easy to see a job, well done. On the other hand, modern life has brought with us the idea that many of us can choose what to do with our one wild and precious life, which was not a choice many people had for a long time. Now, some of us manage to choose work that is clearly useful in itself. We teach. We make sure a criminal defendant gets a fair trial. We try to reverse the damage that our species has done to the planet. But sometimes the ultimate importance is not quite so clear. And it certainly isn't clear on a day-to-day level that we're making any difference at all. When Barbara Ehrenreich, writer Barbara Ehrenreich, supported herself with minimum wage jobs for a year for the research on her book Nickel and Dimed, she concluded that when you sell your time by the hour, you are selling your life. And that if you work for minimum wage, you need to have at least two jobs if you want to live inside. Karl Marx thought, and I agree with him on this point, that human beings are fundamentally creators. He wrote that when a worker feels alienated, it's because he is deprived of the right to control his or her own actions and to own or enjoy the things, the goods and services that are produced. And you know how you can find in the Bible anything for which you have good reason to look? Maybe you were waiting for that reference to Deuteronomy. It says, "You shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain." In other words, while the ox is walking around the threshing floor processing your grain, you ought to let him take a bite of it. The surrounding verses are about paying your poor workers before sunset, leaving some of the harvest in the field for people to glean, and so forth. Now, the context is a little messy, and I think it obscures the content to some extent, but the principle can be clear. Those who have a part in the creation of something deserve to be able to enjoy it. Now, Henry Ford is said to have addressed this. He was not an admirer of Karl Marx, in case you were wondering. When he raised the wages of his workers to a then princely $5 a day, he allegedly said that it was so they could afford to buy the cars they were making. Now, modern economists scoff at that. They say he raised wages so he could get the best workers in town, so he wouldn't have such high turnover, and he wouldn't have to spend so much money training new workers. One modern economist pointed out that people who work on the line at Boeing wouldn't be able to expect to buy a jet plane. Well, no, they probably wouldn't. But I think they might possibly reasonably expect to buy a ticket. And I think the story about Henry Ford identifies something fundamental about our relationship to work. And I'll get to the rest of that in just a minute, but first, part of the spiritual path in reward for our job is the way that you do the work. Martin Luther King Jr., said, "If a man is called to be a street sweeper, he should sweep streets even as a Michelangelo painted." Sorry, it's hard to keep from imitating him. "Or Beethoven composed music, or Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should sweep streets so well that the hosts of heaven and earth will pause to say, 'Here lived a great street sweeper who did his job well.'" Now, it's an inspiring thing to say, but you and I know that somebody, possibly a supervisor, would say at some point to that street sweeper, "You know, anybody can do what you do." Probably had it said to you at some point. And in fact, Michelangelo's boss, Pope Julius II, had pretty much the same attitude toward the great painter. Now, Pope Julius knew that Michelangelo was a good painter, but he thought he, the Pope, was the important guy. He was the one history would remember. And Michelangelo was just somebody he hired to paint the ceiling. A farm worker, Roberto Acuna, told Studs Terkel in Working, "Working in the fields is not in itself a degrading job. It's hard. But the growers don't recognize you as persons. That's the worst thing about it, the way they treat you, like we have no brains." And then he goes on to say something I found very interesting. "Now we see they have no brains. They have only a wallet in their head. The more you squeeze it, the more they cry out." That contempt so often runs both ways. And I think it can be toxic in more ways than we might think. I was once talking to a friend of mine who works for Solidarity International. It's the international arm of the AFL-CIO. I mentioned to her that labor unions often seem to me to be surprisingly bad employers, willing to exploit workers in ways that they would fight bitterly about in a corporate workplace. And she said, "Yeah, you know, they often are." And her theory was that it was because they have so little respect for the job of management. From what they've seen, there's nothing to this management gig. You just boss people around and you squeeze every last dime out of them. Now, I think that behavior undermines the very work that labor unions are supposed to be doing, and it creates misery for everyone involved. I think we are all fundamentally creators, and we should have a share in the work that we create. So, am I saying that so many of our economic and social ills would be solved if we just all heeded that first Unitarian Universalist principle we've heard about today? If we just treated every human being as worthy of dignity and respect? Well, I don't think it would solve everything. But I think if we don't treat each other that way, that solution is unlikely and progress is impossible. Application of our first principle would go a long way toward taking the poison out of our work and out of our lives. We create the world we live in. We will likely create the one our children live in. Our spiritual decisions determine what kind of world there will be for us all.